Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop and welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. This episode's an interview with Code Speaker from Edinburgh. Bob and Greg, we have a little sit down and talk about the post-metal scene and talk about the scene within Scotland, the differences between Glasgow and Edinburgh, and touring now. They're currently out on tour and I suggest you check them out, as I suggest you check out their full album as well and everything that they've produced so far, which is absolutely superb. So if you do want to appear on the show, just send me a message through the socials and we'll make it happen. It's nice to speak to new bands. It's nice to discover new music all the time. There's some fabulous stuff going on within the metal scene at the moment. This is my conversation with Bob and Greg from Code Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a really nice pleasure to have these two gentlemen on the show. It's a band that I kind of stumbled upon, which is amazing because their album that I've been listening to pretty much since I found it is superb. And it's great to speak to a new band that I've never heard of before who are producing music that I'm really into. So it's nice to bring Greg and Bob from Code Speaker onto the show. Welcome onto the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Mark, how are you doing, mate?
We're doing all right. Edinburgh's finest. And I suppose I want to get into the Scottish metal scene and what it's like and what it was like for you before and during this being in a band. But I always tend to start with where it all begins for you. What's the first music, not even metal, that you guys are hearing? Like, Greg, what's the first things you're kind of hearing when you're growing up?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess my... to be honest, like, my music was pretty kind of nothing for most of my growing up until I kind of got to high school, really. Like, listen, yeah. Like, my mum always had Elvis on in the car and stuff like that. But kind of, I guess, getting into high school and stuff, I would say probably like Alexis on Fire and that kind of post-hardcore type thing was my first kind of step into anything louder, heavier. I'd imagine Bob's the same, but, you know, 10 years earlier, whatever Alexis on Fire grew up with. But,
all right. Yeah. Fine. Nice one. Yeah. But back in the age when music came on physical media. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess for me, it was kind of that way. And through kind of the metalcore scene as well, you know, obviously like metalcore was kind of a big thing at the time. Killswitch and stuff were going strong. So through there, and then I guess it kind of, I've always stuck with that. I've always listened to a lot of hardcore and punk and stuff like that. And my music taste has just kind of got a little bit sillier and louder and angrier as it's gone along. And now I spent quite a lot of time listening to like what could reasonably just be described as noise, but you know, it's all good fun.
Isn't it interesting that when like kind of Killswitch were first about, the terms like metalcore existed, but it wasn't there, was it? It wasn't like, you know, oh, we're a metalcore band, or it didn't exist, did it? It was in hindsight. They're seen as the purveyors of it, as the kind of like some of the founding fathers of it, aren't they? It's interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never really, you know, it's like, and then they became the kind of like the flag bearers for it. It's interesting that you have to do something slightly different for them to be kind of like the guys that open the door for everybody else. Were they like your kind of first band, the band that you like just everything that they brought out, you were into and completely digested?
I'd say probably Alexis on Fire were that for me.
Right.
You know, I've just always been a big fan. Actually, I went down to London to see them a few years back when they did like three shows around the world for like a comeback tour. And it was just brilliant. Like them and Killswitch as well are actually like every time I've ever seen those two bands, they've been better than album quality sound. They've just been absolutely unbelievable every time. And I'll go and see them from now every opportunity I get until I die. They're just just fucking phenomenal.
What about you then, Bob? What's your first kind of musical leanings?
Oh, right. Well, gosh, therein lies a tale. So, like, similar to Greg, I guess until I was kind of in early high school, I basically listened to, you know, whatever my parents put on. And that was your typical 60s pop. And to be fair, like, a love of Motown, which I still have to this day. And then, but that's obviously not what we're here about. So, like, getting, you know, later on and through into that, I guess I got into Maiden when I was like an early teenager, but I guess the first, to step it back a little bit, I'm a massive, massive nerd. And I did like nerd things at university. And when I went to a LAN party, if we remember what those are, a bunch of nerds connect all the PCs together. And at that, when I was about 18 or 19, before that I was kind of into, you know, just Kerrang stuff, I guess. And maybe that age, I got, like, I did a massive music share thing. Like, someone ripped my music hard drive, I ripped theirs. And on there was just a whole bunch of stuff, which basically kind of ruined my life from there on in. So, like, I got, like, all Godspeed You Black Emperor records. I got all of the Converge records. So yeah, I guess, and I suppose those would be the two big ones in terms of stuff that sent me off down this path of listening to weird stuff. Like, it's really stereotypical to say, but Jane Doe was an absolutely life-changing album for me when I was a youngin. Greg's probably grimacing because we went to see Converge and Jacob's voice has been horrible both times. So Godspeed to this day remain probably my, like, Godspeed You Black Emperor, probably my biggest influence in all of this stuff. I can't get it, you know. I never heard anything so bleak and so different and so away from where, you know, all the other stuff that I listened to. And I guess the very, very first thing that I super got into and was obsessed with was almost certainly The Fragile by Nine Inch Nails. Like, that, okay. I was a proper Trent obsessive for a while. I don't know. So a whole bunch of stuff. But I still think, like, The Fragile, Contentious Opinion, is the best Nine Inch Nails album. I'll defend that. Yeah, I listen to that a lot to this day. So yeah, all over the place. But Refused, that'd be another big one. So Ship A Punk To Come. As Greg says, what he likes, but 10 years earlier, because I'm old.
But the key thing that kind of runs through both of those sort of answers is that those were all bands that stepped out, or not outside, but certainly to the side of metal. None of those are straight up metal by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. You know, somewhere like Converge and stuff like that. These are kind of slight sidesteps and different slants on heavy music and how that is, and certainly when it mixes with hardcore and it mixes with a punk ethic as well. It was and like The Refuse, you know, it's heavy as you want, but they would. I mean, the album's called The Future Sound of Punk. They assume themselves as punk, a punk band. It's just interesting that we love those guys when they step out of line and they step out of what is expected. And one of the things that comes up a lot on the show is that that's often where the coolest stuff happens. You know, you look at Faith No More and the things that they did and what Patton was doing outside of Faith No More were all dangerous and not very sort of, you know, correct things to do and the right way to waste. They weren't going to sell a million records, but they were important for a band's growth and to make it interesting. It's interesting that you both have those leanings and, you know, sure that there's the Maiden in there and all the rest of it, but very quickly you diversified into the things. And Bob, you say that sounds like a mad mix of things. To me, it sounds like a complete balanced mix. I would listen to those albums in various orders. I mean, The Fragile, that's an incredibly dense and difficult record. You know, it's challenging, it's accessible, but it's still pretty fucking bleak, isn't it? It's pretty dark. How old are you when you're listening to that, then? How old are you?
God, I don't know. I'm 39 now, so I was like, when I'm 99 was, coming up 15, 16, I guess.
I was going to say it's about 15, 16 years. That's heavy stuff already to be kind of filling your ears with, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone in the band has variations on that leaning. Like, I don't think any of us were ever big Metallica fans or Megadeth fans or like any of the kind of, you know, like the big straight down the middle ones, metal guys. I mean, I think everyone in the band has a little bit of a kind of pretentious streak in wanting to listen to
it. Not a little bit.
And just wanting to listen to like our drummer's really into like a lot of his jazz stuff, a lot of his kind of modern jazz stuff. Our bass player plays in a band called Frontier, who are effectively just noise. and
extremely wonderful, compelling, abstract.
Noise. Phenomenal. If you ever get a chance to see that band live, honestly, you will not regret it. But it is just noise. So I mean, I think we all just. I've never been one to listen to the same thing for a very, very long time. There are very few albums that I will listen to now that I listened to when I was 18. I always kind of want to listen to something new and hear someone do something a bit different, you know?
Yeah, just to be challenged and go, okay, this is new. I'm going to have to take... This is an interesting thing that comes up. It's only a few sort of genres of music really have this, where in order to get into an artist, you have to initially first find it almost inaccessible and have to repeatedly listen to it and understand what's going on before it opens up into the wonderful world it is. You know, something like black metal can seem very, you know, very unapproachable by design. But then once you open it up and find that the traits that are exhibited within the music, it becomes way more approachable. You know, death metal has a similar thing against it as well. There isn't too many genres of music to have that. Everything's kind of geared to be initially very pleasant or very attuned to what you're listening to. It doesn't want to be difficult. Whereas metal talent kind of wears it as a badge of honor, right?
Do you know what, Mark? My lockdown project was like listen to genres that I don't really understand or don't really like. And black metal was one of the ones on there. I'd never liked black metal, like especially the early stuff. I didn't like the production. I didn't like the silly comedy vocals or, you know, what I thought at the time. So I was like, nah, this is bollocks. There's got to be something, you know, there's got to be good bands in here. And there are. Like there's ways into these things. And all the true cult metalheads are going to hate me for this one. Obviously, Def Heaven, you know, Alcest, all that stuff is a way in. And then I don't even know how to pronounce them, but MGLA, Mgla, I think, from Poland. I'm probably saying that horribly wrong. And then from, like, starting to get that stuff, like Behemoth, obviously a massive, like, you know, huge band. But I didn't really know that stuff. I wasn't into it. So, yeah. Yeah, you can find your ways in, and there's good stuff in absolutely everything.
Did you guys have any kind of gatekeepers? Did you have like a guy in a record store or an older sibling or someone who kind of go, well, okay, you like this, but look, trust me, this is where the real shit is. Listen to this. Did they have any kind of gatekeeping, or did you have to kind of blithely stumble around to find the things you like?
Lots of stumbling around, but like. Just asking people's who musical opinion I trust, like Greg, the rest of the guys. There's a Scottish scene of folks in like Tiberius, which is a band who are pals of ours, and Frontier again. Just like asking folks, like I know I'm wrong on this because I'm being a dafty. Can you tell me like somewhere where I should go and listen if I like this kind of stuff? And from there, you'll hive off into new things and you'll be like, oh, actually, this is amazing. And I'm an idiot, which I always knew. So, yeah.
I think another benefit we've had is that both of us have been playing music since we were very young. Yeah. We've been in bands since forever. So, like, we've got a lot of friends that we've met through music and stuff, and they've all introduced us to their friends who play music. And as we've grown with those friends, they've all diverged and they all play everything now. So there is an element of like when your mate's band comes up with something just fucking daft, you kind of just listen to it to be nice for a while, even if you think it's shite. And then once you've listened to it, you're like, actually, I kind of get this a little bit now. And then you can start having conversations about, oh, what were you listening to when you wrote this and stuff, you know?
Yeah. So
a little bit of sympathy listening goes a long way.
That's entirely. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to end the show now because Greg has summed up the entirety of how we should approach metal and heavy music in a beautiful soundbite there. I would probably use that as the head of the show because that's great. That's exactly what it is about. You're meant to, when you meet up with your friends, you're meant to do that thing, be like, listen to how fucking heavy this is, or listen to how crazy this is. I remember one of my friends bringing the first System of a Down record. And laughing as he was playing. He was like, look how ridiculous this is, amazing. It's I've never heard anything like this. And he was so excited to get me into it. And at first I was like, what's going on here? And he kept playing it. He was like, you've got to accept that this is amazing. And I love that. Like, I think that's another trait that metalheads have that maybe no one else does, is there's almost like a race to find the heaviest, the most offensive, the most darkest, the most complicated and whatever music. And there's almost like a race to it, like, you know.
Yeah. So always digging a little bit deeper, you know.
Yeah. So when does it start for both of you to go sort of down an instrument or a vocal sort of channel? When does that start? So you're listening to this music then. Does that encourage you to pick up an instrument or what happens?
For me, it was entirely typical. I heard Nirvana when I was 11 and I was like,
there it is.
I'm going to go buy a Squire Strat and the Wee Mark. And that was it. Like, at the point I was playing the trumpet and I was getting reasonably good at it. And I kind of wish that, do you know what? If you're a trumpet player, there's always a gig, right? There's always a gig. And I'll tell you what, unlike being a fucking guitarist when there's 10 years, but if you've got a trumpet, this is your rig. And for people listening, because obviously you're on a Zoom call, your rig is a trumpet, right? Carrying your trumpet to a show and the teardown from a show carrying a trumpet is pretty easy. You do not need a van to carry a trumpet. And I kind of regret that side of the decision. However, I do like big riffs. It's good fun. So, it was, I suspect, a very similar path to many. Hear Nirvana, pick up a guitar. Yeah. And
was it an accessibility thing? So Nirvana write deceptively so, but they write simple riffs. It's like, you know, it sounds very simple. It's not. Obviously, as musicians now, we understand there's a lot more going on. It's interplay between musicians. But was it an accessibility thing that he's bringing this punk thing almost to it?
Do you know what? It honestly...
It was easy?
I was an idiot, like, early. And I was like, oh, this is so much cooler. And if I do this, girls will pick me and I'll be a rock star, you know?
Yeah.
Shit that you
know, what Bob's talking about is the real reason why some people pick up an instrument. It's not to be creatively interesting and outpour this wonderful musicality that you have going on within your soul. Sometimes it's just to look fucking cool.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I did
because like, you saw someone else look cool and you're like, I want to look cool like that. Yeah. I can copy that.
If you play post-metal or if you play any genre, especially kind of a one which is so gear focused as post-metal, right? That you don't get, it's what happens after gigs. The joke is, it's like you get large men who are bald with large beards coming up and asking you about your pedal board. That's what happens in this genre. What's on your... Is that a Model T? That kind of...
Hey, you guys are going to be touring soon and doing some shows with Pound. And Ryan, a beautiful human being, and I've watched exactly what you describe.
Yep.
I've seen him almost accosted by a group of males trying to find out which order he's running his true bypass through. I've seen that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. How does your ABY work? You need to split the bass to here and there. What's the pedal that does it?
What the fuck? It's a dry wet signal. What are you doing that for? I've been there.
Nice set, man. Now tell me about your rig. Yeah, that's what happens.
I usually just run off to the merch desk afterwards. Yeah. Like, you guys can deal with that.
So what about yourself then, Greg? Where does it become from listening to then performing? Where does that sort of transition?
We can go a wee bit far back or we can go really far back.
It's fine, let's go.
Let's go really far. Right. So when I was wee, like really wee, like seven, like six or seven or something like that, I used to go away for Christmas with my family, my gran and granddad and that. And it was a place up on the West Coast. And there was always a band playing and they always did requests. And every year I went up and sang Angels by Robbie Williams. And that was my Christmas tradition for like 6 years.
Your turn, the thing that you could do.
Yeah, that was the thing I did. Every like 6 years went up, just slowly getting worse and worse as my voice starts to break. So that was kind of where I was first singing, I guess. And then I kind of just dropped that for a wee while. I played drums for a wee bit. I was pretty shite. But that was basically what Bob was saying. There was a dude that came in when I was in first year in music class. There was a dude that came in from like 6 year. And he came in to just like show off the drums and say, hey, drums are cool. You should take drums. And I was just like, yeah, that was rad. I want to do that. The surrounding like three blocks of houses where I grew up disagreed with me. They said I shouldn't play drums. I kind of stopped that after a little while. And then I just had some mates putting together a band and like just cover stuff, really. I think all sorts of weird stuff. They did like Fall Out Boy and like the Kinks and just everything in between, just all sorts of like rock covers. And they needed a singer. So I ended up doing that. And that band just started getting a bit angrier and heavier as it went on over kind of 4 or 5 years. And then from there, I ended up mostly just yelling in bands. And I've been in fucking dozens of bands at this point.
What was that first band called?
Back in the depths of time, your way high school band.
It was called, what was it called? Avum, A-E-V-U-M. I don't know what it meant. I'm sure it was something very deep and meaningful.
Probably, but it sounds like it means multiple eggs.
Yes, it does. Ovum. I'm sure it was Latin for something. I can't remember. You're like 13 and everything is drawing like swords and fucking Slipknot logos on all your math jotters. Yeah, that's where I was at the time.
Do you remember playing shows then early on? Do you remember kind of getting out there and doing it? Do you remember your first couple of shows?
Yeah. Yeah, they were much busier than any of my shows nowadays. people actually fucking weren't bored of me at that point and they still showed up to my shows. But
I believe the diplomatic way to describe them is the crowd were more discerning now.
That's what it is. Yeah, exactly.
It's a very specialist crowd.
We do all right now, Greg. Don't sell ourselves short.
So what about yourself then, Bob, playing live? Do you remember when you made that transition from in a practice room to actually going out and doing it?
Just loads and loads of shite one-off bands with my pals where I was growing up, and then a university band that wasn't particularly good, and then just a series of other shows, and other bands. I was super, super into math rock, 65 Days of Static, all of that kind of stuff pretty much immediately after. But this band was supposed to be originally like a tippy-tappy math rock band, and that went down the tubes. That didn't happen. It rapidly morphed into something very different. And so it was just lots and lots and lots of, I'm playing some shows with my pals, and we'll get a gig in Newcastle, or we'll get a gig in the Working Men's Club or Carlisle or whatever, and then move up to Edinburgh and just play local shows, do a few like tours back then and stuff. And it's just, I think, a pretty typical trajectory. Just play with your partner.
It used to be a typical trajectory. Now it's moved to a very different thing. So back then, certainly when I was in bands, you kind of joined a band every other weekend and you played a bit. And if it worked out, you maybe did some more shows. And if it didn't, you just changed the name or you changed something else and off you went. Sometimes it was defined by the gear you had. If you had just early on 7-string guitars, then that was probably what you were going to be playing, that type of stuff. And it kind of lent to the work. And now it seems to have shifted to be people are like, I'm looking for exactly this band and I want to form exactly this thing. And I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing. I think that it's nice sometimes to just go, fuck it, let's just play. Let's see what happens. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Because otherwise, if you go in kind of with like a lot of set expectations, you can kind of almost put yourself into a corner straight away.
It's an interesting like effect of this hyper targeting that people have to do to try and get an audience nowadays. So they have to be like, well, Periphery or Tesseract are, so we will target this and we will sound like this and we will have this hyper niche scene and this hyper niche scene. And I'm not sure that it used to be like that. Punk and metal are a very broad church, but I think it's just a side effect of the if you want to get heard, and especially with the new distribution mechanisms, people say, we are going to target people that sound like this band. And you end up with these hyper niche kind of things when that's never particularly been, you know, my intention is, yeah, I mean, you can obviously hear the personal influences and the you know, the Godspeed and the Pelican and the Cult of Luna and all of that stuff and all the Doom stuff in there, but we hope to not be so pigeonholed, if you like. We hope to throw in lots of other things that interest us and lots of other styles and, you know, like some more fast hardcore-y stuff and all kinds of stuff. So it's...
I think that's a really good way of describing to maybe someone who would, there will be people listening to the show who don't really understand post metal and don't really understand where. I think you've explained it quite nicely there. That is what it is. It's there's a lot more range. Not that metal doesn't have its range, but certainly with post metal, there's a lot more. It's more encompassing. Its remit and the sort of the funnel's a bit bigger to get to the final sort of the final piece, and it's just open to a few more things. And I think that, you know, I said this before, that a lot of the experimental sides of metal often find their ways into the more kind of mainstream, you know.
Yeah.
This has come up a few times with someone like Slipknot, where they initially, when they started, it's like there's many people in a band, which is totally unheard of. It should be four, isn't it? And then there's a DJ. Well, there just shouldn't be a DJ, but there's like, okay, there's even to the point where having just more than one guitar player was seen as being kind of almost outlandish in some respects. So, but eventually... Yeah. These things make themselves into the mainstream. We talk about, you know, like Periphery and Polyphia. Now they're almost the first points that people will, if you wanted to learn impressive, you know, guitar playing and put it on YouTube, you would see those guys. You would see Tim Thewson, and you would see Itcher and stuff and people like that playing all these incredible things because algorithm's geared to showing you amazing things. So it's interesting. The more it gets pushed away, it gets pulled back in a bit, you know?
Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
No, if you're looking for that kind of stuff now, it's not Vi or Satriani or any of that. It's your man from Polyphia. It's Tosin Abasi. Yep. It's that kind of thing. And let's not mess around here. Like they're doing stuff that's never been done before. Like there's you can say whatever you like about Polyphia, and there are things to say, but they make music that has not been made before. I went with for a long time not liking them and thinking, what was it, that Adam Neely quote, the Limp Bizkit of prog? I like them. So there's a whole, I don't even know what my point was. Sorry, bring it back.
someone like Polyphia is just manifesting the end result of maybe some of the social medias and the way we ingest music and the way it's produced. We're kind of seeing that with them now, you know, how it's produced and how it's put out there and what's considered acceptable anymore. They've changed those games. I mean, love more, hate them. And like you say, rightly so, there's some things about it that maybe aren't as good and some things about doing it great, but you're right. They're not doing anything that's been heard fairly recently. You know, it's not Edward Van Halen, Jimi Hendrix type of level of changing of the game, but it's certainly making you look at it in a different way.
Yeah.
I think there's, I think like we're talking about kind of the new forms of distribution and stuff as well. Like, I think that they're along with that, and I'm not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing necessarily. Like, I think it's, you know, any opportunity that people have to make music and, you know, get it out there is an awesome thing. And it's great to live in an era where that's possible. But there does tend to be a little bit of emphasis on being the somethingest band, like being the heaviest band or the fastest band or the, you know, because realistically that shit's marketable, you know, like when we were kicking about in the spare music cupboard doing fucking Jimmy World covers and stuff, like, we weren't thinking about what was marketable.
Yeah.
We were playing some music, some shit music with our shit pals who were all shit music. Whereas what you can get now is talented folk, you know, like really talented folk that have never played in a band. They've maybe recorded their entire album themselves at home. They've maybe done that several albums. I mean, Cloud Kicker is a perfect example of this. Live from Cloud Kicker recorded stuff by himself, and he was pretty early on in that home recording type thing as well. And then people were around the world were dying for him to tour, and he was like, "I can't tour. I don't have a band." Like, and he had to put a band together. But like that, 20 years ago, that's impossible, right? Like that's the absolute opposite of what you did. You got good, you toured until you died, and then hopefully you stumbled across the right date at the right time and someone was there.
Yeah.
Whereas now these guys have the, you know, if you've got the ability to do it and you've got a little bit of marketing savvy as well, realistically, you can produce that music on your own and you can chuck it out there without ever having to have slept in a van at the side of the motorway, you know?
Yeah.
Frontiera, the band that Calumet, perfect example. So they recorded records and put all of that stuff out and got a following from the online only, all done in, you know, Pedram's bedroom, pardon the expression. And and that came from that, and then gigs came afterwards. It's totally the other way around. So
yeah, I mean, there are like I remember the first instances here, and someone like Chimp Spanner, or even Pliny, who's now has a touring band, so, but originally was just him, one man operation, and off he went. And let's not be fooled here. Music is quite a lot of the time defined by the technology that precedes it. Like, you know, we think about like singles in a jukebox. The reason of that size is to fit in a jukebox. That's how you played those music. Yeah. That meant that it was a 3-minute pop song. So a 3-minute pop song was born from that. And then that's how so we shaped it into that. You know, that it used to be an album, a piece of vinyl was on two sides, and bands would write with that in mind. You know, someone like Pink Floyd would write one side would be Wish You Were Here. The other side would be a collection of songs, and it was meant like that, which we're seeing that now, only potentially from a digital and social media point of view. It's interesting. And I don't think none of it's a bad thing.
Absolutely.
We just have to understand the things are moving into a different sort of period. You know, like you say, the Limp Bizkit of that type of music. Even Limp Bizkit have been almost reinvented and refound by bands, you know, and refound by, and now it used to be, it went from being very, very cool. Everybody in the world was talking about them. Then they went, well, no, it feels like it's misogynistic. It feels like it's not very good here. This feels like frat boy rap metal. No one wants it. And they were ostracized and it was everybody's favorite band to kick around. And now they come back again and somehow it's like, yay, Limp Bizkit are back. You're like, hold on, they really haven't changed at all. But the society that's placing them has. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah,
I didn't expect to be talking about Limp Bizkit and
we're talking about Robbie Williams, we're talking about it all tonight, ladies and gentlemen. So when does it go from the separate bands to you guys meeting? What are the beginnings of Codespeaker?
So as I was saying before, this was originally meant to be a sort of tippy tappy math band, and this kind of gradually organically turned into what it was. There were some pals that I'd been in a previous band with, and we were like, all right, let's try doing something a little bit different. We'll get synths in, we'll see if we can trigger some stuff and all of that. And it came in, and basically the previous incarnation of the band just started slowly morphing towards adding heavier stuff, and then the synthesizer and sequencer disappeared. Then the singer started shouting instead of singing. Then fuzz pedal. And just, it was never like, oh, I really like Dope Smoker, let's play long, slow riffs. That was never like the intention. And Greg happened to be at one of our shows. I think it was the last show that the previous singer was at. And I said on stage, our singer is moving to Cambridge. If anybody here is interested in trying out for us, we're looking for a new singer, so please come and talk to me. So he did. And then, like, we had an EP out at that time in the old band. He listened to it and auditioned for it, and he was really good. So we said yes, and that was kind of it.
I mean, the kind of even going from there, like the band itself is weird. Like it's had name changes. It's had the whole shebang going back, what, 9 years at least. Long before I joined. But I mean, now Bob's the only original member technically.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Because it's just kind of sprawled back into the depths of time at some point. So, yeah, I mean, even from there going on, obviously if you've checked the album out on Bandcamp or stuff, there's credits on there for the guys that were in the band at the time that aren't in the band now. And like, that's kind of been part of the growth as well, as just been like taking in all of these other, these influences and whoever's, you know, there at the time is it's awesome to have worked with so many co-musicians in the project and had so many completely different, interesting points of view. And it's always kind of been our aim to really nurture that a little bit and say, yeah, okay, we've got a drummer who really likes death metal, or we've got a, you know, singer that really likes hardcore, whatever it is at the time, and lean into that a little bit, you know. And I think that's kind of how we ended up with what we've got, which I guess comes back to your point about post-metal. You know, I think it gets a bit of a bad rap these days, people saying, oh, it's all Cult of Luna clones. But realistically, like, it's not a very tied in genre about what you are and are not allowed to do. You know, you can comfortably push boundaries a little bit. You can add in some blast beats. You can add in some fucking pig squeals. You can add in some whatever you want to do. And it can still, you know, sit nicely in that area where people aren't too knocked on the head to hear it.
Saying that, I don't know that we're going to go full grindcore anytime soon.
I don't know.
Yeah, we'll
see how it goes. Yeah. I've been listening to a lot of Nails recently.
I don't know the history. That's why I was asking, because when I encountered the album, it seemed like a very well formed unit already. It seemed like very not confidence, but certainly sure footing about what you want to do and what you want to say. It seemed very, it still seems like, even when I listened to it before I came on the show now, just to kind of have it in the ears, it just seems still wide open. Like the next album you do, or EP or single or whatever it is, could be anything. It could really go in, and that's a wonderful thing to do, because most people try and personify what they do with their first, if you will, their first album. They try and personify it. You seem to have essentially just opened a whole bunch of doors ready for the next thing, you know?
That's very sweet of you. And I think there's a pretty deliberate decision that musically there's some writing patterns that were like, okay, we're going to try and break those a bit on the next one. Like there's some tricks that we do kind of rely on a little bit too much. And there's definitely some influences with the, you know, the new folks that we are incorporating. Like we've got some... you know, we've got some new stuff on the way for the next thing, and there's definitely, yeah, it's going to be like, I've got no idea how it's going to pan out because we're writing at the moment, right? But you know, we'll see. But thank you. It's very sweet of you to say.
Well, it's true. That's exciting to hear, as you know, from a musician. Is like, we don't know which way this is going to go, and we're excited to try a whole bunch of things. That's a great, that what that shows is longevity, because you're clearly doing it because you enjoy it and are open to whatever, you know, someone brings an idea, if that works, let's roll with that. And that translates to longevity for a band. It's as simple as that. It just does. You know, you say you're already onto some of the tricks that you're doing way before the listener will maybe even get into that, and you're willing to go, okay, let's fucking break that then. Let's change that before it even becomes a thing that people know us for. It's tough, because that's going to alienate certain people who want to expect the next album to sound exactly like this one, which it just won't. But it'll also bring in a people that will really kind of gravitate. We talked about this, about difficult, complicated, or, you know, not necessarily commercially viable music. And it really adds to longevity. There's all, ladies and gentlemen, if you listen to the album, I will put links onto it. There is all kinds going on with this. Cult of Luna is such an easy thing to say to this, but it's still a million miles away. It's like, you know, there's Neurosis and stuff, and there's all kinds of little things going on all smattered around there. So I suppose, just to take a sidebar for a second, what is What's the scene like in Scotland then, from a metal perspective? What is it like there? I've been up for a few shows. I've seen some really good examples. I like some of the stuff that I'm seeing coming from our Scottish friends, and the scene seems to be relatively healthier. What is it like up there?
I guess I've got a little bit of a bone to pick with kind of the more to do with the councils and things like that are not right. super supportive of the scenes. They like to shut down venues left, right, and center. They like to make it very difficult licensing wise for actually being able to put shows on, which then means that hiring a venue is extortionate. You know, it's really difficult to put shows on. But I would say that the music scene in Scotland has been really remarkably resilient despite that. I would say an unusually high density of very talented bands that somehow managed to get through that that struggle of realistically a lot of big bands when they're touring, they don't bother coming to Scotland. So you miss out on a lot of the big support slots, you know, all of these sorts of things can have a big impact on the trajectory for a band, you know, and those big support slots can be the bit where you get your face in front of folk, you know, and if bands don't come to Scotland, you don't get those support slots. So whatever, if venues are getting closed down left, right, and center, you struggle to put on shows and this and the other. But fuck man, there's some really very 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 good bands from all over the spectrum. Like,
I had Hellripper on the show a couple of shows back, and he was singing a very similar tune. It was like, you know, I mean, you guys are based in Edinburgh. Do you suffer from the fact that that's a very popular tourist place?
Yes.
And, do you suffer from that? Yeah, because at Liverpool, we most definitely have issues where. You know, someone will make this into a block of flats and the building next to it is a music venue that's stood there for 20 years.
We've lost so many venues like that. We lost a really big one called Studio 24, which was the rock and metal nightclub as well. It put on a lot of shows there and got shut down because the council sold all the buildings next door to it. They turned it into flats and then someone noise complained and they shut it down. And that's happened and keeps happening all over the city. I can't even count how many we've lost that way. So it's kind of been the venues have been concentrated down into just one area of the city called the Cowgate. They're all almost around and in and around the same area, except for the really, really big venues. So yeah, it's a really big problem. Like it's also got the, there's a real Edinburgh versus Glasgow thing here as well. So you'll tend to get the bands in Glasgow if they are touring going there rather than here. But that's not to say that there's not, good, healthy people who, you know, scenes and people who care in non-Glasgow places. Like there's some really, really good like DIY and punk collectives like Make That a Take in Dundee. There's some superb promoters out there who give a shit, like Duncan at Red Cross, who puts on Red Cross Festival. Like Red Cross last year was three days and multiple venues, and it was the most attended like mid-sized show I've seen. You know, there was hundreds and hundreds of people seeing like really mixed bills, and it's I feel like it's in rude health at the minute, and it's a really good thing. And there's people who care, and people who try even in the face of everything trying to stop it happening. You know,
yeah, that's 100% the lifeblood of it. Really, is the folk that are realistically, you know, in most terms, doing a pretty fucking thankless job of grinding away, never really getting a whole lot back for it to keep that scene alive, and like those. Those guys are the reason that there is a scene in Scotland, is that we're lucky enough to have, you know, a few characters like that keep it all rolling.
Yeah, it has to be. It's so frustrating. Now we have it with our council here, and they have it. There's issues going on in Manchester as well about, you know, you've got this beautiful thing within your city this beautiful creative thing that solves a lot of ills. It's not necessarily a silver bullet to solve social ills, but it certainly helps solve a lot of social ills, is just neglected to the nth degree. You know, you get, like, we all know that, you know, being in a band is a positive thing. It's socially positive. It's good for mental health. It's good for socializing with other people. It's good. Everything wins with it. You know, it's someone, you know, deciding to pick up the drums instead of, you know, maybe choosing another lifestyle that's bad for them. And, you know, and people coming together and realizing that they're all into the same thing. These type of things are the lifeblood, like you say, of a city. And it's just the Music Venues Trust is currently waging battles to make councils aware of the validity of musical stuff that's going on within the city. And then it's interesting that you talk about it's difficult to get like a support slot for touring bands because they don't pass through. Is it really that big of a divide with Glasgow and Edinburgh? Every time I've been up to Scotland, in fairness, it's mainly been Glasgow and going up to the academies and what have you. It's very rarely I've gone through Edinburgh. Are you losing out to them then? Does that happen like we do with Manchester and Liverpool sometimes?
It's just the way that the scene is and where the audiences are. It's just for a long time, like, Edinburgh gigs had a reputation of being a bit shit comparatively, so
definitely,
you know, they would just go to Glasgow instead. And I think it's kind of reversing now, and we're starting to see, you know, more bands coming, but it was definitely a thing for a long time. It was like, they, you know, they wouldn't come through, and if you're looking for a local slot, it would go to a Ouija band.
Yeah, there's also a venue gap there, though, right?
Yeah,
like from the absolute massacre that our venues have had over the last kind of couple of decades. Like, you know, you're all right getting a venue up to maybe 500 people. North of that, you're pretty fucked until you've got, you know, somewhere closer to like 3,000-4,000. You know, there's really nothing in between. You know,
yeah.
So if you're selling more than 500 tickets, you're not selling, you know, 5,000 tickets, you're going to have to go to Glasgow because it's the only place with sensible venues, you know.
Yeah, you get to see that where it. I often talk, especially to young bands who are kind of just joining the scene or just becoming bands themselves, is I like to talk about a route map to how you become a headlining band for like a festival, or how you become the next Download. There should be a route map to that. Yes, there's elements of luck, and we know that plays well, but there should be a route straight away when you go from a venue where you only do sort of 150 to 200 cap venues, and then there's nothing in between 3,000, 4,000, 500. There's nothing in between. Yeah, it stops it in its tracks, and bands don't get the chance to grow. You know, the only way a band grows, like from a live point of view, is by playing the larger places. You learn the different ways of operating in front of a crowd. It's the very essence of a growing artistic community. And it's, yeah, you're singing a song that I've unfortunately heard quite a lot, but sometimes what I find is that, like you've said, in the face of this, though, bands kind of rally a little bit. And some of the best stuff is when it is against the odds. You know, certainly for aggressive music and certainly for heavy music.
Definitely. I mean, you see bands, you see a lot of bands, these kind of more niche bands, they end up touring themselves half to death because it's the only way to do it, right? Like, I mean, it would be... I'm maybe just saying this because I don't have the savvy to do it. Like, it would be nice to be one of these, you know, cloud kicker type deals that we were talking about earlier, where you have the talent and the ability to put that out to the world and skip that bit. But realistically, what happens is bands make their money by selling a couple of t-shirts at a show, and they have to be playing shows, and they can't play the same city over and over again because those people have their t-shirts, so you've got to go somewhere else. But then when you go other places, you've got petrol costs now, and you've got van hire costs, and you've got to find someone's floor to crash on. And like,
well, it used to be so many bands I knew that would be like, oh well, we'll go to Europe because they treat us so much better there, and
can't do that anymore.
The guarantees are five times as good, and we'll get food and we'll get treated 10 times better. And they did, and even smaller bands will have that. And
£600 and, you know, 50 pages of paperwork just to get across the border now. So, you know, I mean, we're booking, we've got a tour in April coming up around the UK, and we've been very, very lucky in that, like I said, you know, we we know a lot of people in the music scene just from having played for so long and stuff, and they've all been incredibly helpful with helping us get this stuff booked. But like, if you just moved to the country and you were trying to start from scratch without that basis, without that community behind you, like you wouldn't get shows, you know, like it's impossible. And therefore you wouldn't be able to like keep that train rolling, because you wouldn't be able to, you know, sell the t-shirts and pay for the next studio costs or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
There's the funny meme of the guy sad, and it's because he's too born too late to discover new places in the world, and born too early that he can't explore space. So he's kind of in this valley, and it feels that that's where we are now, as we wrestle with what social media and can give you, and you can be a social media band, if you will, and almost a band that doesn't play live that much, and a band that used to play only live and had no understanding of social media. We feel we're right in the middle of this thing where it will work itself out to sort of a bit of a more common thread. It feels like we're in that middle section, you know, where no one really kind of knows exactly what to go for. Because I was reading an interview only recently with Polyphia about them saying that it's kind of TikTok's kind of over. And I was like, oh shit, is it moving that fast that as a new medium comes up, it's almost over 2 or 3 years later?
I can't even figure out Instagram. Like, well, I hope that there's some middle ground between like, we can play a fun few shows and we have to descend into the singularity. That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, of course. That's the thing. Like, I don't want to say this to sound like doomy and gloomy at all,
because
realistically, like I said, we've made so many fucking great friends through playing music.
Yeah, yeah.
We've played so many amazing shows with amazing bands, and like, it's been an absolute joy and a pleasure to be part of that scene and still doing it despite the odds, despite, you know, whatever else comes up against you, whatever the council wants to throw in your face. Like, it's been a fucking pleasure, and we wouldn't still be doing it if it wasn't, you know, and we still continue to do it. And, you know,
this has been a perfect example. So I stumbled across you guys through social media, you know, that's demonized, but that's how I find you. I'm now able to see you on tour because of the old school, let's tour us and get to places to see, but I'm going to be able to see you guys and I can have a conversation remotely to tell people about how great your band is, you know. There's lots of positives. There's lots of opportunity. It's just the way you go into it. You know, okay, this is the situation. We can either moan or we can adjust and fix the things that we need to do and try and get everything across that we can do. The truth is that the one consistent line through all of this is writing quality music.
Yeah. Exactly.
The end. And that will always trump most things on a long enough timeline. And so it's nice to kind of, like I say, it's nice to hear the likes of yourselves. And there's a couple other bands I now listen to off the back of listening to you guys that I've seen kind of, and I will check out Frontier as well, which is great. I love hearing bands that I've not heard of before. It's the best thing in the world, because
for a fucking treat, man.
You sold me so high on them. They've got to be the best thing ever, you know? So where are we now with CodeSpeaker? What have you got planned? We've got the tour coming up, which I'll post dates and links to after the show as well. What's the kind of the slightly longer term plan after that then?
It's tour, and then we've got a good few songs in like a, you know, half done state, probably enough for another record. Greg is an absolutely brutal editor, as is the rest of the band. So it's like we put stuff together, demo it, bouncing back and forth. And he's like, no, that's pish. Change that. Tear that up. So, and he's right too. So it's a good thing. So we'll do the tour. Then we'll get heavy into writing. And then ideally we'll be getting into recording again this year for number two. And we don't know. That's going to look like. Yeah. But that's the next thing, really. A few more videos and...
Yeah, I mean, timing-wise, with when the album came out and everything, we kind of missed a lot of the booking for the festival circuit this year, which is kind of how it plays out. So I'd love to do festivals next year, play some of the festivals that we've been to and that we love, and, you know, like that would be a bit of a kind of a landmark thing for me, just to say, like, I've spent many drunken, muddy days in these fields, and now I'm kind of on the other side of that barrier would be an amazing thing to do. So yeah, keep playing shows, keep writing music, pretty much. That's more or less where we're going.
That's the way forward. It's so easy to give this up at the first, you know, kind of adversary type of thing you come across and the first trouble you have. You go, okay, look, we're not going to tour anymore. Or no, we're not. It's you know, just keep going, keep writing and keep applying yourself. You know, that's a great message. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, if you feel that the juice continues to be worth the squeeze, just keep going. You know? Like it's, I fundamentally just love playing music with these four idiots, and that's, you know, what I like. So yeah,
I mean, I guess I've said this to Bob as well before. Like it's especially over the last few years, have obviously
COVID
had they've had a load of shite and stuff, and like. Mm. It helps so massively to be in a band with all your best mates, realistically, like, because there definitely are times where you're just like, here, this is shit. Like, what am I doing? Like, I'm fucking old.
Yeah. Like, it's cost me so much money.
I'm in debt.
Sick of low debts. How many times have I carried that bloody 412 up
the I'm bed? Sleeping in a van. Yeah. I hurt for 4 days after every show. Yeah. What's the fucking point in this? Like, yeah. There's definitely those bits where you give up and you think, right, well, what would I be doing if I wasn't doing this? And they're like, well, I'd still just be hanging about with those guys. So we may as well be like playing some music while we do it, you know? That makes a massive difference. It makes it much easier.
Listen, you know, one man can beat 10 and 10 men can beat 1,000. So it's cool when you're all on the same side and you're all kind of going for it together. And that's what, ladies and gentlemen, if you listen to this album, which I strongly urge you to do so, you're going to hear that. You're going to hear a lot of interesting stuff, some quite challenging stuff as well, if it's not something you've been listening to, but ultimately very rewarding. And it's going to be nice. We'll get Coach B. Grant again, naturally, as we gear up to maybe just after the tour and maybe before we hear the next album. That's something I'm excited for, and you should be too if you're listening to this. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been really great to have Greg and Bob from Coach B. Grant. Thanks for coming on, guys. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much,
Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Bob and Greg there from Codespeak are currently out on tour, and I would suggest checking out their newest album as well, which is absolutely superb. Also, if you do want to appear on the show, as I've mentioned, please feel free to DM me and contact me via the social medias. I'll be doing a lot more preview shows and interviews, and a lot of the feedback wants to hear more of doing the listening episodes where I go through entire albums and the history and with a particular album, which I hugely enjoy. So I'm going to be starting doing some of those as well again. Once again, thanks as always for listening to the show. The feedback is absolutely incredible. It's really nice to hear. It's really nice to get suggested new bands all the time. And it's great to see eventually when I go to the show, talk to the people out there about the show, and they're telling me what they like, what they think I should be doing on the show. I want to take all that feedback on board and do some stuff with that. But as always, thanks for listening, and I'll see you at the show.